TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ice Core Climate Records of the World, Professor Lonnie Thompson. In 1952, the Danish geophysicist Willy Dansgaard made a discovery that opened up a completely new field of research. He found that the amount of heavy oxygen isotopes in rain correlates with the temperature at the location where the precipitation was formed. His theory was tested and confirmed on snow and icebergs for locations and periods where temperature records exist. The next project was to go onto ice sheets and glaciers and drill ice cores, hopefully down to bedrock, and recover the temperature records of the past. The first ice core in Greenland was drilled between 1963 and 66 in a top-secret operation at Camp Century by the U.S. military. They were testing the feasibility of deploying nuclear missiles from the Arctic. Camp Century was abandoned in 1967, but made news in August of 2016. The thawing Greenland ice sheet now brings abandoned infrastructure and hazardous wastes off Camp Century to the surface. Many had believed they'd be buried in eternal ice. However, while in operation, the scientists at Camp Century allowed Willy Dansgaard access to the ice core they had drilled. And the first ever ice core temperature record came from this Cold War operation. They reached the depth of 1,387 meters and estimated that they had gone back in time 100,000 years. Among the many discoveries associated with ice core drilling that today gives us 800,000 years of history for Antarctica and 123,000 years of history for Greenland, is of course the ability to see and test the annual layers of snowfall, melt, and embedded dust particles that can be carbon tested for age. All this is an extraordinarily important tool for understanding changes in world surface and atmosphere. But more important, in preparation for climate change denial in the U.S. administration, is the record of carbon dioxide that is preserved in the ice cores. The tiny air bubbles encased throughout the ice core are not just tested for heavy oxygen isotopes and the temperature of the time, but also for the amounts of greenhouse gases. The correlation of temperature rise and decrease with increasing and decreasing carbon dioxide and methane content have become one of the most important proofs for climate change, both natural and human-induced. Ice cores also show the recent extraordinary increase in the amount of CO2 since the Industrial Revolution. Lonnie Thompson is today University Distinguished Professor at The Ohio State University in the School of Earth Sciences and the Byrd Polar Research Center. In the early days of ice core research, he was still a student. As a farm boy who loved science, he had been the first in his family to go to college. He remembers seeing his first ice core and the intriguing rings that form like vertical tree rings with each annual layer of deposit. Early on, he wondered what other secrets might lie embedded in that ancient ice. An impressive library of ice cores already existed for Greenland and Antarctica. Thompson learned from his teachers how important it would be to drill ice cores into the inland and tropical glaciers, from Peru to Chile to Tibet to New Guinea and many other places. He decided that this was going to be his life's work. He was undeterred by the doubts expressed by his teachers and mentors. Willy Dansgaard told him that human beings were physically unable to do ice core drilling at altitudes of 18,000 feet and more. that no equipment existed that could be brought to the tops of the inland glaciers, and that it would be extremely difficult to get the ice cores down the mountain before they melted. In a moment, you will hear an interview with Lonnie Thompson, who's now in his late 60s and has drilled in 16 countries on 61 expeditions. In 2009, he collapsed during field work in Peru and had a heart transplant 3 years later. Doctors told him he could no longer go on expeditions at high altitudes, but he proved them wrong. 1 year after his transplant, he spent a month on a west central Tibetan ice cap. A year later, in 2014, he did follow-up research on the North Wall Fern in Papua, Indonesia. And in 2015, he revisited the Kalkua ice cap in Peru and also led a 60-member expedition onto the western Kunlun Mountains China Glacier. He was 67 years young that year. Lonnie Thompson's passion for his work is the driving force for such perseverance. Also, his experience shows that the glaciers he loves are melting within his own lifespan. In a race against time, he's helping assemble the precious record in ice of the last 800,000 years. Lonnie Thompson was interviewed by the University of Queensland, Australia, Making Sense of Climate Change Denial Project. Here's Professor Lonnie Thompson, School of Earth Sciences and the Bird Polar Research Center at Ohio State University.
I made my first trip to Antarctica in 1973 as a graduate student. It's kind of interesting that the way things come to be, because all the work at the time I started was on ice cores was being done in the polar regions, in Greenland and Antarctica. And all the pioneers in our field were alive, and I had a chance to meet them when I was a student. In 1973, there were so many people working in Antarctica and in Greenland that came up with this idea that wouldn't it be great to have a record somewhere in between to compare, look at the connectedness between Antarctica, climate from Antarctica, and climate from Greenland. And so there was a geographer who had made an atlas of the glaciers of the world. And he had all these aerial photos. And in these photos, we found this tropical glacier called Calcaya in the Andes of Peru, 18,670 feet. And took the photos to what was then the Polar Programs, because they were the only agency at the time that funded ice core research. Made a case to the program manager, wouldn't it be great to look at something in the low latitudes to connect to the high latitudes? And he listened, and he said afterwards, his name was Jay Zawali, he said, you know, Lonnie, that sounds really interesting, but you know, I can't fund it, because we can't fund anything that's not north of the Arctic Circle or south of the Antarctic Circle. So in 73, 74, in the winter, I went to Antarctica, and back then they had telexes. And in February, I got a telex from Jay Zawali saying, quote, that I have funded all of my real science projects and I have $7,000 left. What could you do on that tropical glacier for $7,000? And I telex back and said, hey, I think we could get there. And in the summer of 74, we made our first excursion to Peru up in the Andes, found this ice cap, and that opened up a whole new area of research. Not quickly, I might add, because it was clear there was a record there, but we still had to find the funding to be able to go there. And being young and naive, I thought we would just make a contract with the Peruvian Air Force and bring the drill and the generator from Antarctica, and we would fly the helicopter up through the Andes and get it up on the ice field, get the drill out, drill the cores, put them into the helicopter, and fly them out. Well, that was a great idea, but and when we got a contract, and we actually tried this in 1979, and we had to fly the helicopter 13 hours to get it into the region, and there were no airports up there, so we had to bring the fuel in by train on a boxcar And we staged out of the back of a small town in Sequani in the Andes. But when you got the helicopter up to 19,000 feet, even in beautifully blue skies, it would just fall because there were updrafts and downdrafts and there was not enough air to support it. And eventually the pilot said, no, we can't do this. And so it was my first really big failure. I mean, I've been funded by NSF to do this. I was told by the pilots they could do it, but in the end they couldn't. And there was a two-day journey from the end of the nearest road to this ice cap. And so you could only get there either walking or using horses. And the drills from Antarctica were too big. The generator, no way you could put that on a horse. So that year, we actually went to the ice cap and we sampled down a crevasse. We got a record going back 25 years, which we published in Science. It's those things in life where you come to a point where, is this possible? I mean, and this was the first time we thought about using solar power, because a solar panel can go into special made bags that can be put on horses. You need 40 panels. You get as many horses as you need to transport them to the edge of the ice. And so we came up with this idea, and we took panels there, and sure enough, they performed 20 to 30% above specs of manufacturers. But of course, we had to get reviewed for getting money to build a solar powered drill. And this is 1983, and solar power was just coming online. And so Willie Dansgaard, who was one of the pioneers in our field, reviewed the proposal. And he sent me a copy of the review he sent to NSF, National Science Foundation. And it was very short. It said, Quelccaya ice cap is too high for human beings, and the technology does not exist to drill it. Therefore, you should not fund this project. Fortunately, there was a program manager who said, who was interested in monsoons, and had gotten his PhD studying monsoons. And he said, well, maybe Willie Dansgaard is right, but we won't know unless we try. And so we built this solar-powered drill. We tested it on a parking garage in Columbus, Ohio. We brought in blocks of ice, and we were able to drill through the blocks of ice. Looked like it would work. But 2 weeks before we left on the expedition to drill there, I passed the MBA exam, the Fisher School of Business, because this, if I failed, it would be my second failure, and I figured I'd need a new career line. And I really like Willie Dansgaard. I'd read all of his papers when I was a student. So we went down in 1983, and we succeeded in not just drilling one core to bedrock, but two, and bringing back 6,000 bottled water samples, because we hadn't devised a technology to keep the ice frozen, but we could cut it, prepare it in the field, and carry it out with horses. And we brought it out, and one set of those samples I sent to Willie Dansgaard, who analyzed them, and it was such a fantastic record that from that day on, he was our greatest supporter on why we needed to drill in the high mountains around the world. I always tell my students, it's very important at an early age to fail, because it's in failure that you're really pushed to think about, is this what you really want to do? And to think about, okay, how can I accomplish it? Success, you don't learn that much. Failure, you learn a lot. And it's good to do it when you're young, because no one knows who you are. And if you fail, yeah, it's a big deal to you, but it's probably not for the rest of the world. So that's kind of how we got started. And that ice core opened up a whole new field. And we've now drilled in 16 countries, including Antarctica and Greenland. I just finished my 58th expedition to New Guinea. No other time in human history would it be possible for one human to do this, because we move 6 tons of equipment to these countries and go through customs and get them up to these remote areas and get the ice core back frozen. It's amazing. I would have never thought when we started out that this would be possible. But now we have an archive. We have over 7,000 meters of core stored at minus 35 degrees in our freezers at Ohio State. It's the only tropical collection on Earth. And no one has duplicated this because of the team. It really comes down to people. The team that we were able to put together, they know what they're getting into, and it's tough working at above 20,000 feet. But they're marvelous records.
58 expeditions over 4 decades. What changes have you seen?
When we started in the 70s, you know, there was no discussion of global warming. In fact, they were talking about the coming ice age because there had been crops failures in what was then the Soviet Union because there had been some cold winters. So we didn't go there to look at the changing climate as much as to understand how a tropical glacier works versus those in the polar region. And going back to these places, we were able to document the changes that are taking place. And what was really incredible was initially how slow the glaciers were retreating and then how they have accelerated coming forward in time. And in such that many of the sites that we drilled early in my career have disappeared. And you cannot go get those records now. And therefore, the archive we have, I mean, we cut our cores in half, and half of them go in the freezer for the future. Because we know there'll be new techniques, there'll be new ideas, but you're not going to be able to go out and recover an ice core from the summit of Kilimanjaro in Africa, because the ice is not going to be there. When I look into the future and 100 years from now when I'm all forgotten, I think what will be remembered are the quality of the records that have been obtained because those isotope values, those dust measurements, those chemistry measurements, they're not going to change. The interpretation of those may change, but those records will be there. And then the archive for future generations to work on will be a good legacy. As time proceeded, it became very clear that especially the lower elevation glaciers, and by that I mean glaciers at 5,000 meters, 18,000 feet, were going to disappear first. So getting those archives in recent years have become almost a salvage mission. When we went to New Guinea, I mean, in the center of this tropical rainforest, I mean, this is the middle of nowhere. It was to capture what's left. We should have drilled there in 1935 because we have some old photos. There was a lot of ice there, but we got a record at 32 meter cores to bedrock, and they have a marvelous record in them. I mean, these glaciers, it's not just their area that's shrinking. They're no longer accumulating on top. They're losing mass from the surface down. And to me, this is a this is one of the problems of using satellites to measure glaciers, is that you're not really measuring the volume change of that ice. And yet if you are in the Himalayas, where you have millions of people downstream depending on water, those glaciers will appear to be there on a satellite image, but they are thinning vertically. One year there'll be glaciers, and the next year that glacier will be gone. On Kilimanjaro, those ice fields are thinning at about half a meter a year from the top down. And so on the Furtwängler Glacier, if you're looking at it from a satellite in 2017, there'll appear to be a glacier. In 2018, just be bedrock because it's going from the top down. I think the implications for water supplies in these remote areas, I mean, if you go to a country like Peru, 70% of the tropical glaciers on Earth are in Peru, in the Andes of Peru. Here you have a country of 34 million people. Over 50% live in the desert on the west coast of Peru, depending on rivers that originate in the glaciers up in the Andes. 76% of their electricity comes from hydropower, the water coming from those glaciers. They have a very distinct wet and dry season, so that, you know, glaciers are kind of like an insurance policy. They accumulate snow during wet seasons and wet periods, and then they melt and release that during droughts and dry seasons. But they're getting smaller, so their ability to do that becomes less and less. So this has tremendous implications for people who live in areas that depend on those water resources. Because downstream, that water goes for those hydroelectric plants, it goes into irrigation, it goes into municipal water supplies for cities. And you go to a city like Lima, Peru, that have 15 million people in it, they are looking at putting in tunnels through the Andes to capture water now that goes into the Amazon and bring it back to the West Coast for water supply for people. So the implications of the change are tremendous in these areas. And I think in the tropics, there's where you're going to see the first real impacts on people, because the people are living right downstream below the glaciers, and there are large numbers of people living downstream. So what's happening to those glaciers become extremely important. When I first started working on this and seeing the system change, I think it was 1992 when I first testified at U.S. Senate on climate change. And back then I talked about prevention. So that time has come and gone. I think now it's the mitigation, the adaptation, or the suffering. And so as we go further down this road, our options are becoming less and less of how we deal with these changes. If you're working in Tibet, there are 46,000 glaciers there. And you take a river like the Indus River, it flows through China, through Pakistan, and through India, all nuclear power countries, all depend on that river for its water supplies. These are places of geopolitical hotspots in the future. You look at population projections for the world. By 2050, 50% of the world's population will live in mega cities in southern China and India. So that water becomes more and more important as we go forward in time.
There's a common argument that climate scientists are only agreeing with the human-caused global warming because they're in it for research.
I have never understood that argument. Anyone who's in science will tell you up front, this is not where you go to make money. Science is, it's where you, if you have a passion, you go there to seek that passion, to fulfill a drive that you have within you. But I must say that I have come to understand skeptics on climate change much better because of an incident that happened when I came back from Peru in 2009. I went to the Ross Heart Hospital and I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. And my cardiologist looked at me and he said, Lonnie, he said, you know, in your future, you have one choice and one choice only. And that is, you're going to have a heart transplant. And I looked at him and I said, you're crazy. I've been climbing the highest mountains in the world I was 63 years old at the time. And I fought this guy every step of the way for 2 years. I mean, I was running expeditions to New Guinea. Then I was in the Alps drilling in 2011. And in one day, I couldn't get up from my tent to go to the drill site. I couldn't breathe. And I came down and I ended up getting out of Italy back to the Ross Heart Hospital at Ohio State University, went right in the emergency room. They put me in, put me initially on a heart pump, and they had to put in an LVAD system, which is a turbine that was invented 6 years earlier, that goes into your old heart, and you have a computer on the outside, and you have a drive line, and during the day, you run on batteries, and at night, you plug into the wall. And 6 months later, there was what turned out to be a pretty good match, and I got a heart transplant. 1 year after that, I was in 2013, I was at 20,000 feet, and West Central Tibet, doing what my passion is, recovering these records. But I use the story because I believe that I had two options. The reason I didn't want to believe that it was congestive heart failure is that if you put that on your medical form, there's no way you'd be permitted to go to climb the next mountain to run the next project. So I'd rather believe that it was asthma. But the fact is, at the end of the day, we deal with what is. And what is was that I had to have a heart transplant. And when it comes to climate change, we will deal with what is because the system is changing and we will have to deal with it. But unfortunately, as human beings, we don't usually do these things until we have no choice. And then sometimes we can still deal with it. It may be touch and go for a while, but things can get better on the other side. We have now an 800,000-year history of CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and we know that we have not had levels of CO2 at 400 parts per million by volume in 800,000 years of history. And we know that that's rising about 3.2 parts per million every year. And we know where that CO2 is coming from because we do the isotopes of the carbon. We know it's coming from fossil fuels. So we know we're changing the composition of our atmosphere. We know the temperature of the Earth is going up because we have thermometers all over the world, and we have a record that goes back 130 years to document that fact that temperatures are going up. At the same time, the glaciers all over the world are melting and retreating, and that's what you would expect if the world was getting warmer. And that water is flowing into the world's oceans, and sea level is rising, and the rate of sea level rise is accelerating as the rate of glacier melt accelerates. So the evidence is very clear where we're headed and the fact that the humans are driving it. It's a matter of physics and chemistry. And at the end of the day, science is about what is. And what is we're changing the climate system. How long it takes us to actually make meaningful advances on dealing with this problem, to me, is the only question. The fact that we will deal with it is a given.
That was Professor Lonnie Thompson, University Distinguished Professor at The Ohio State University in the School of Earth Sciences and the Byrd Polar Research Center. He has drilled in 16 countries on 61 expeditions and gathered the largest body of ice core records on inland glaciers of any paleoclimatologist of our time. And nobody will ever be able to duplicate his work because over 90% of the glaciers he worked on are melting. Lonnie Thompson was interviewed by the University of Queensland, Australia, Making Sense of Climate Change Denial Project. They're an international team teaching online courses and presenting interviews on their YouTube channel. They bring information to the public to help deal with the arguments of the climate change deniers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.